Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Valentine's Day. Does Ronald Reagan still run the Republican Party? One of the people interviewed in the three-part documentary series that is airing this month on PBS, The Reagan Presidency, makes that statement. The documentary, which is put together by a person you know well here in Milwaukee, Chip Duncan, documentary filmmaker, one of our guests this hour. This documentary provides a look at all 8 years here, the policies, the politics, all of the events in the world, the domestic issues that the Reagan presidency was dealing with and that shaped history from 1979 to 1989. There are fabulous interviews with all kinds of people, including Bill Bradley, who's always worth listening to, Douglas Brinkley, editor of the Reagan Diaries, professor of history at Rice University. Gary Hart is here. Robert Reich is in this film. The chair of the Council of Economic Advisors is interviewed, the former Secretary of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, Henry Cisneros. Sandra Day O'Connor is interviewed in the film, and many others. Edwin Meese. Sandra Day O'Connor? The list goes on. We're going to be talking with Chip Duncan, filmmaker and author and photographer. I think we last spoke with Chip. Maybe we talked with him after this. He did a documentary on Herbert Hoover, who turns out to be a much more interesting man than many of us thought he was. He is president of the Duncan Group, and he's working on a film now we'll ask him about toward the end of the broadcast this hour on global warming, and he's a great photographer doing photographs of what's happening to glaciers. Chip is with us. Chip, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi,
always
Chip.
Great to be with you.
Yeah, great to have you here. And Tracy Dorsey is also with us. Tracy is also a producer of the Reagan presidency. Tracy, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
You interviewed so many important people and people who were involved in the administration, some who were opposed to the administration but realized the value of Ronald Reagan. What do you think about the comment, I believe, made by Richard Reeves that Reagan still runs the Republican Party? Chip?
Well, I think in terms of domestic policy, there's no question that the Republicans today look to Reagan as kind of an iconic figure, and certainly, there's people even within the Republican Party from the Tea Party side who hold him up as an icon, and then the moderates do as well. So, the question that the party probably has to answer now is whether they'll continue to do that.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Tracy?
I think that we've seen in past debates that Reagan's name is mentioned again and again and again. I think Chip's right. People do hold him up as an icon, and many have their own view of what his presidency meant, which was one of the reasons that we went back to reexamine Reagan 30 years later.
Mm-hmm. Douglas Brinkley reminds us of his unlikely path to the presidency. Chip, a radio announcer, a movie star, failed at some attempts at office, becomes governor of California, and then becomes president. This is kind of unlikely, isn't it, as you've looked at other presidents?
Well, it is, although I'd have to let the listeners and potential viewers know that we really only focus on the presidency, so we don't spend a lot of time on his life leading up to that time. But certainly, and Robert Reich, I think, makes an interesting comment early in the film where he says, did he have the gravitas? Well, yes, he did.
Mm-hmm.
And, unexpectedly for some, but certainly, when he ran in 1980, the question we pose in the film and try and answer is, did he win or did Carter lose? So we start with the hostage crisis in Iran and look at the impact that had on the Carter presidency. And so by the time Reagan, comes into office, really is what is happening here? Is Carter losing or is Reagan winning?
Mm-hmm. There was so much. Please tell me about this particular documentary. All of a sudden, there was all this video available. This was a president who you could look at reams and reams and reams of interviews and statements because it was all there. It wasn't on tape. It was on, what do you call it? It was archived. It was on video, right? You're the filmmaker.
Well, and I have to tell you, I was in a discussion with another Milwaukeean, Dwayne Dudek from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he asked me a question about Reagan's kind of iconic status and how did that happen. And I just mentioned to him, I said, look, I started as a news photographer, and in 1980, we were still shooting film. which was a very expensive thing to do, and you had very limited loads in your camera, and so you didn't record everything. You had to be very judicious about when you turned the camera on and off. And when video came in, that was a major shift. So Reagan's really the first president where we have, hours and hours and hours of material. And one thing that Tracy and Pat Ostermick and Stevie Ballard, the archivist, tracked down that was fascinating was Reagan brought the radio address back in 1982. And when he brought it back, they videotaped the radio addresses. And nobody had used them before. We're the first people to stumble on them and include them in a film. And there's amazing commentary that Reagan provides while doing the radio addresses. And so, that's the video generation at work right there.
Right. So many, Tracy, of the people who you interviewed, you and Chip, for this documentary series, really do give Ronald Reagan credit for being a masterful communicator. There was something about, and I can't remember who said this, that he provided this kind of steady leadership that, I think it was Robert Reich, that there's something to be said for somebody who is in charge, even though you don't like what he's saying, he's got a firm hold on things.
Yes, Robert, that was one of the comments that Robert Reich did make, that, while he might not have agreed with the framework that Ronald Reagan had in place, at least he had a framework, and that Americans took great comfort from knowing that there was someone in charge with a framework in mind.
Mm-hmm. When you talked about the Iranian hostage crisis, and I guess we forget, and Walter Mondale reminds us, your interview with him, which was interesting, that he came to office during that time period and then never mentioned, even though the hostages were released on the day of the inauguration, I believe, never really mentioned that again, but it played so largely in the whole campaign, didn't it, Chip?
Well, certainly in the campaign, yeah, it was huge. And in part, Carter made a lot of decisions that maybe in retrospect he would have done things differently, but he barely campaigned. I mean, I don't know that he was taking Reagan lightly, but he simply was so focused on the hostage crisis, he didn't get out, he didn't tour the country. They only conducted one debate. And, it wasn't enough for the American people to really get a sense of who, Jimmy Carter was at that point in time. I mean, people forget, but that crisis went on for 444 days.
Right.
And, a lot of careers were made at that time, Ted Koppel's being one of them. But, you see that play out, and it's a really interesting question. Who, did Reagan win or did Carter lose? Certainly, in terms of who became president, Reagan won. And I don't think people expected that when the election process began.
So many of the issues, Tracy, it was fascinating to me that we're dealing with now were also being dealt with during the years of the Reagan presidency. The deficit, the debt, the unemployment rate, tax policy in this country. Isn't it interesting to look at what he was doing and we're still doing the same kind of debate?
Well, I actually have to say that, much to my surprise, one of the most fascinating parts of hour one is the whole deficit discussion and the tax policy discussions, because we are going through the exact same things right now. So it's interesting to tap in to 30 years prior and see and ask how far have we come.
And I might jump in, Tracy, just to add, I love it when in the footage we dug up from the convention in 84 that it's Mondale challenging Reagan over deficits versus the other way around.
Yeah, I was chuckling when I saw that as well. The unemployment rate, you have some dramatic pictures of people who are homeless. Some of them are in Milwaukee. There were a lot of people who were really hurting. Unemployment over 10% during the first couple of years, but things changed. Can you talk about how bad it was and the policies that were put in place that changed all of that, that probably allowed him to be reelected?
Paul Volcker, takes a lot many people give Paul Volcker a lot of credit for the changes in the economic policies then, because he wrung inflation out of the economy at that time. And many people give him, hats off for really turning the economy around.
Mm-hmm. Chip?
It's interesting on the inflation issue, Kathleen. When I was doing a speaking engagement in Des Moines, and when we were done, a banker came over to me, and I had mentioned that inflation had gone over 20%, or excuse me, interest rates had gone over 20%, and a banker came over to me and he said they actually hit 22 point blah blah blah, and he had it down to the decimal point, because when interest rates were, you know, really that high, the question became, how do you combat, you know, inflation and any number of things. And so, yeah, Tracy's right. I mean, Volcker gets a lot of credit for it in the film, and of course he's in it, so he gets to speak for himself. But, you know, there are a lot of people who would say, well, you know, who did recover, and did we ever recover? I mean, unions changed significantly at that time. You know, interest rates, once they were brought back down and unemployment started to, you know, to at least come back to manageable rates, I think Reagan gets a lot of credit for that, but so does Volcker.
As we're rapidly approaching the time when we may have only one airline in the United States, I found the air traffic controller strike video particularly compelling, because here was a president who really had highlighted the value of unions, and I believe was president of the Screen Actors Guild for a number of years. So his dramatic action was really dramatic action, Tracy, wasn't it?
Well, you know, Robert Reich even points out that, yes, he did take dramatic action against the striking air traffic controllers, but he also points out that those employees were government employees who had no right to strike. It was illegal for them to strike, and it also put the country in grave danger, according to Reich, you know. So the fact that Reagan did take decisive office was, in Reich's view, the exact appropriate response to that strike.
Chip, why did you decide that you've already done one on Herbert Hoover and you're going to do more? I'm interested in who you'll take on next. Why Ronald Reagan?
Well, Kathleen, we felt, and I'm actually going to say, I may be wrong about this, but we felt at the time that we started that we were far enough away from the administration that we could create a piece that was objective, that got beyond the polemics and the politics, and really was not a polarizing film. And I don't think it is.
No, it's not. Right.
Yeah, I think we succeeded in that sense. But at, you know, when I've been out with audiences in particular, they still come with their own expectations, and we're getting people from the far right or the far left who still have a lot of value judgments about it. So I may have been wrong that we've come far enough to just look at it as a historical piece. That is what we tried to create, was something that was, you know, in some ways almost like a play by play of the 1980s, with analysis and insight that would help, in its own way, reveal the truth of what happened at that time.
Well, I think you accomplished that. You accomplished it through people who, like Robert Reich, Bill Bradley, and others, who had completely different philosophical ideas about government, and yet were able to analyze the Reagan presidency pretty even-handedly, I thought.
Yeah, they sort of check their differences at the door,
right?
And so there's almost a diplomatic kind of approach that a lot of the interview subjects take. What's also interesting, though, and we haven't really talked foreign policy yet, but I think when you look at hour one, which is all domestic, you come away with a sense that, oh, isn't it interesting? We're still fighting about all of the same things,
right?
You know, immigration, farm policy, you know, interest rates, you know, and yet when you get into hours two and three, there's a lot happening on the foreign scene that nobody had really talked about before. When we started production, we knew we'd be talking about the Cold War. That was obvious, but we didn't really anticipate spending as much time as we do on the Middle East. And so, you know, Reagan's Middle East policies are quite interesting in retrospect. When you look at, you know, especially post 9/11, you look back and you say, wow, how did we get here? And a lot of the underpinnings in policy happened, you know, during Carter and Reagan. And so we tried to bring that in. And I think those are mostly new insights for viewers and listeners.
Tracy, you want to comment on that?
Well, I actually think that is one of the most engaging parts about the documentary in an hour or two. I mean, Condoleezza Rice draws a direct line from the events in Lebanon during Reagan's administration to the fact that the United States had to confront, you know, a global war on terrorism, mm-hmm. ending with the attacks of 9/11.
Mm-hmm. And you could also, I believe it's Walter Mondale who talks about the emergence of, this is again from the first part of the documentary in the series, talks about the whole Iranian hostage crisis. We're really seeing perhaps the beginning of a radical form of Islam here, too, that played out so significantly in the subsequent 30 years, didn't it, Chip?
Mondale's best quote in the whole film might be, you know, if you want to live a life of heartbreak and disappointment, get involved in the Middle East. He wasn't trying to be funny when he was saying it, but it sort of plays humorously in the film because the quagmire that continues there, certainly they were dealing with it. Mondale and Carter were dealing with it, and certainly you see it really explode when the U.S. makes the decision to go into Lebanon in 1982. And of course, that policy leads us to the bombing of the embassy in Beirut, and then the Marine Corps barracks, and ultimately a withdrawal that, in some ways, helps further the cause of Hezbollah. Mm. So it's these are policies that, you know, they play out over a long period of time. You can't necessarily see where it's going, even in the late 90s. I'm not sure we knew where it was headed, and so you analyze it with the. With the lens of 9/11, and everything looks a little bit different.
Let me ask both of you, starting with Tracy, both of you have spent, I can't imagine how many hours looking at speeches by Ronald Reagan, looking at video of his life and announcements and signing bills and arguing for things, et cetera, et cetera. I'm wondering, Tracy, let's start with you, just what you think was the key here. I, at the risk of being too simplistic, I've always thought that he had this lovely Irish charm about him, that he was charming, and it could be disarming how charming he was, how he could use television and he could use radio, and sort of had this glint in his eye that made you think that he was up to something, but he was okay, even though some of his policies, many would think, were pretty conservative.
Well, there are a couple of comments on that part. Paul Volcker, for one, says that he believes that was one of Reagan's biggest contributions to the country, his sunny disposition, the fact that the country, regardless of how tense things may have been, especially, during the Cold War, that they could look to Reagan, and Reagan always seemed upbeat and optimistic. So I think that kind of confidence in his own skin kind of helped set some Americans at ease. And then also, harking back to Robert Reich again, you might not have agreed with where he was leading us, but he was leading. So I think that played a big part in his what has become the icon, the myth of Ronald Reagan.
Chip?
Well, I would agree with that. I mean, his communication skills were obviously outstanding, and the sunny disposition is true. I mean, you think about the politicians at that time. I mean, Tip O'Neill could be angry and funny in the same span of time. So, it was a little more true with O'Neill. It was a little more true with Reagan than you might see with a lot of politicians today who simply come off as cranky, in both parties. And at the time, Reagan just always projected that kind of positiveness. There are a few cases in the film where you see him angry, certainly around Patco. I think when people see the clips of his speeches around Patco, he genuinely looks angry. And as the administration progresses, I think, there are people who've analyzed, how his demeanor changes over time. But, and Obama probably has some of that, too, a fairly upbeat personality that, people on both sides can at least acknowledge that.
One other thing about Ronald Reagan that I was struck, Chip mentioned the radio addresses and the radio addresses that he had given throughout his life. He also was really a beautiful writer. So it wasn't just his ability to deliver a line, but he could construct an argument that was always very interesting. And that really struck me in listening to some of the speeches that we've included in the documentary.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We have several people who would like to speak with you. We're speaking this hour about the presidency of Ronald Reagan. Chip Duncan, Milwaukee filmmaker, who we've interviewed many times before, president of the Duncan Group, and Tracy Dorsey are two of the producers of the Reagan Presidency, which is airing this month on PBS stations all over the country. There are three parts to this series. The first part concentrates mostly on domestic policy, and it looks at a number of big issues that Ronald Reagan was dealing with. The second and third part focus more on the Cold War, foreign policy, Middle East policy, etc. Here's our phone number if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, and you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls now for Chip and Tracy. And, oh, what happened to the phone calls? Hello. There we go. Tim in Ladysmith is our first caller. Hi, Tim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Ronald Reagan, I was a freshman in college when he was running against Jimmy Carter, and he was the first president I was able to vote for. One of the things I really admired about Reagan, and I think he had an ability in his speeches to tie American history and traditional values together, which really rang with especially the heartland of America. And I think that's one of the things that people liked about him so much, is he had just such tremendous conservative type of quotes that still are all over the internet and so on. The other thing I think about Reagan that I remember that really boomed the economy was he understood that business would thrive if you got government off the back of business. That a lot of people didn't like that, but it was one of the key things, I believe, that caused business to really excel in the United States. And so I remember double-digit inflation and 18% interest rates, and that was a terrible time in American history economically. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Chip.
Well, I mean, I think Tim is right that a lot of people feel that way. Certainly, there were a lot of historical anecdotes that Reagan conveyed that were right. Richard Reeves, who's in the film, would also say there were a lot that were actually wrong. I mean, whether the stories he was telling were accurate or not, he made a point of hearkening back to another period of history, and there was a lot of nostalgia in the way that he brought those values into the White House and into American homes.
You want to comment, Tracy?
Richard Reeves actually titled his book Triumph of Imagination, and in Reeves' perspective, Reagan, what he was extremely successful at was imagining a past that didn't exist and bringing it full force, to the forefront for Americans during his campaign and during his administration.
I think, it's interesting. Sometimes there are people who would point out stories that he had told that were actually from, maybe from a movie or a screenplay that he was involved with earlier on. But I'm not so sure that it matters where the story came from as much as the fact that he had a view of America that was kind of tied to the history in the past. And I think Reeves is a really compelling interview subject in the film simply because he says his book, The Triumph of Imagination, it's almost like, whether it's true or not, these are the symbols and the metaphors that he brings to office.
How much credit and how much credit do people in the series give him for ending the Cold War?
That's a big part of the certainly
ahead,
the third hour of the documentary. And I think that people give Ronald Reagan credit for being a very strong partner with Gorbachev in ending the Cold War. You talk to people from within his administration, including Jack Matlock, who was the ambassador to the Soviet Union. And, they say that it certainly was a partnership, but that Reagan, the idea that Reagan won the Cold War is what Jack Matlock calls a myth, that it wasn't, it was a negotiation that was always in the best interest of both parties.
Let's go to Ray next in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Hi, I want to stop the love fest right here. Reagan was definitely a horrible president, and I want to remind everybody who's listening, Reagan used to be a Democrat, and he was also head of the Screen Actors Guild during the hunt for communists, and he named names at the Committee for Un-American, I don't know the title, but it's why they, with McCarthy, when they were blacklisting actors and writers and producers. And when he was head of the Screen Actors Guild, he went to that committee and named names. This guy is like, he's one of the worst presidents of all time. And didn't they hold the hostages until he was signed in as president? Just that reason alone, we need to stop worshiping this guy. He apparently traded arms with the terrorists and made a sweetheart deal with them. That's why Carter lost that election, because him and his cohorts kept those hostages held there until he came into office.
Okay, Ray. Ray is still excited about this presidency. Do you have background information on why it is that the hostages were released on the day of his inauguration?
Well, I think Ray makes some interesting points. I hope you'll watch the film, because it's in no way a celebration of Reagan or a love fest. But we are trying to look at the issues from that entire period of time and shed light on him. We don't get into his pre-presidency, so Ray may be disappointed with that part of the film. As it relates to the hostages, there have long been stories about the idea that there may have been secret negotiations between Reagan's team and about trying to release the hostages, but there was no way that we could include that because there was no way to verify it. At least we as journalists and filmmakers were not able to verify it. So it's not that the story hasn't been out there. We just couldn't verify it.
Mm-hmm. And there was quite a bit of protest during those years. I'm sure Ray remembers all of these protests, but the farmers' protest that you document so well was fairly significant, and it resulted in some changes in giving more aid to farmers who were hurting so badly. Tracy?
Yeah, I think that the figure ultimately was $53 billion in aid that Ronald Reagan signed during his administration. You know, initially he had said that we can't step back, we can't go in and, you know, give a helping hand to everybody in need. But ultimately, given the protests, and he ultimately turned around and gave them the hand that they were looking for. That said, over the next decade, between 200,000 and 300,000 family farms failed.
Right. Ray, thanks very much for the call. Chip has suggested that you see the Reagan presidency documentary three-part series. I agree. It's worth seeing. And how can you do that, Chip? It's being shown mostly during this month all over the country.
It is, and you know, nationwide, we're telling listeners to check their local listings. This is often the case with public television, but in Milwaukee, it is airing. I believe the first episode aired last night.
Yes,
and it airs again hour two next Wednesday night, and hour three Wednesday after that. So it's Milwaukee Public Television that's broadcasting it locally.
Casey is next in Port Wing. Hi, Casey.
How are you today?
All right. How are you?
Awesome. Of course, I was in the military when Ronald Reagan was president. I voted for him twice. And if you were in the military during that time frame, you know how much it was built up and spending was unbelievable. So you were happy when you were in the military. But what I think both your guests don't realize is that once I got out and went into the VA system, Ronald Reagan was just terrible when it came to helping the people in the VA system. He undercut, he underfunded. The VA system almost went broke when he was president. And he was also the number one fighter to recognize Agent Orange as a VA compensation to our Vietnam veterans. And many Vietnam veterans died because Ronald Reagan would not recognize. He refused Congress to recognize the effects of Agent Orange on our Vietnam veterans. And for that, I'm very sad, because a lot of veterans suffer greatly due to Ronald Reagan's ineptness in the VA.
Casey, though, can you really look at any president and say that he's been fair to returning vets? Has anybody lived up to his promise?
Okay, I will tell you this. I'm a career Republican, and I never voted for President Obama. But President Obama has done more for the VA system than the last 10 presidents combined, and that's the truth.
Hmm.
Thank you.
All right, thanks very much, Casey.
Casey, Casey's point about the veterans is a good one, and what's interesting is, you know, everybody has their own areas of interest, and we did spend some time in hour one with covering what Casey talked about. We got into it fairly extensively in our interview process, but I'm not sure that we may not give it as much coverage in hour one as he would like. But we talk a lot about the homelessness issue, and a lot of the homelessness that we saw at that time was veterans on the street, and it was due in significant way to Reagan's cuts of the VA. So I wouldn't disagree with Casey, and we actually do cover it, perhaps not as significantly as he might like.
Mm-hmm. It is, though, amazing to me that so many presidents, the young people go off and we ask them to give their lives, and so many come back seriously hurt, and then we got scandals, you know, and they have to wait in line for years to get services. I've never understood that. Never understood it. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Amy and Cameron. Hi, Amy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just kind of wanted to point out that, you know, everyone's giving Reagan for credit for being this great orator and, you know, being a great communicator. And he was an actor. That was his job before we decided to make him president. And to give him credit for being this, you know, witty, deep-thinking kind of guy, I think there's enough proof out there to prove that he wasn't that guy at all. If anything, he had people around him feeding him lines. And I think there's more than one example of him, you know, missing his mark and having being thrown completely off course.
And yet, Tracy, you said that he was a lovely writer.
Well, there were a number of speeches that he wrote before he even got into office, and that he wrote himself, and they are beautifully written. So there was a lot of talk, and we interviewed people about his intellect. Douglas Brinkley said that, you know, people on the left tend to, you know, underestimate his intellect. And then we have Andrew Young, who says he was an actor and he just played the part and didn't really know what he was doing. So, you know, we do have opinions from both sides who are taking a look at that very issue.
Gary Hart at one point says that he offered simple solutions, and yet he was dealing with some pretty complex problems, particularly when you go beyond the United States and you're dealing with Middle East issues and terrorism issues and the Soviet Union, et cetera. These were complicated, weren't they, Chip?
Certainly, my sense of Reagan over, you know, people have asked me on a number of occasions, did my opinion change? I've never expressed my opinion about Reagan and have no intention of doing so. But my understanding of the presidency has evolved over the course of doing a couple of films, and the complexities are significant. Just, though, to go back for a moment to what Amy called in about in the context of this notion of him as a great communicator. It's mentioned in one or two of the sound bites early in hour one, but we decided not to focus on his rhetorical skills in the film. In fact, at one point, we had a section in on the Challenger explosion. People may remember the speech following the Challenger explosion. It was a speech that was written by Peggy Noonan, and we actually cut it out because it wasn't a policy moment. And there are people who hold him up, you know, who want to talk about his communication skills. I would say, you know, having watched it, there's instances when you can maybe get a sense of who wrote it. Maybe you can't. But we never actually spend much time talking about his rhetorical skills. It's more of a question that people keep asking us in interviews, but in the film, not much time spent on it.
It's interesting, though, that the last book I read about him was Ron Reagan, his son's book about his father at the age of 100, which is a really nice book about him. And at some point, he spends a great deal of time talking about his years as a lifeguard and how that really formed who he was as a human being. And I think that there's a lot of truth in that. And I found it interesting, really interesting, that you focus on the assassination attempt right at the beginning of his presidency, for heaven's sake, and how he recovered from that really set for Americans, and I think for members of Congress, this image of a guy who could take care of himself, who could recover quickly, and who was very resilient. And maybe that just carried along for all of the 8 years. Tracy?
Well, you know, several people do remark, including Richard Reeve, about his ability to bounce back and how he recovered with what such style and such grace and didn't become angry. Jim Engle talks about him not getting angry or not getting sad. So he was greeted as a hero when he came back and addressed Congress right after his recovery. But at the same time, Pat Schroeder laughs and said, you know, and she's also saying she was impressed with his ability to recover, but talks about how difficult that made him then for as an opponent for other people who were trying to steer the ship a little differently from that point on. So, you know, I think that that set him up to become a more formidable opponent for the Democrats at that point.
Yes, exactly.
You know, Kathleen, the assassination attempt is really interesting because, you know, his approval rating went over 75% after that, and it was within the first 2 years. So he was able to push things through Congress early in his administration, in part because of that approval rating. What's interesting, though, and the reason I hope people will watch the film is, you know, the Republican Party, which is back where you started this discussion, has tried, you know, and been fairly successful in making Reagan an icon and making, you know, as if he still runs the Republican Party. Well, you know, the second 2 years, 1983 and 1984, were vastly different than the first 2 years. So after that assassination attempt, I think you start to see a lot of pushback. And one of the great examples is he's known for the largest tax decrease in history.
Right.
But what few people realize is it was just a year later that, you know, he signed off on the largest tax increase in history. So, you know, I'm always one who wants to go, okay, what's the rest of the story?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I hope people will look at that. By the time 1984 rolls around, you're starting to see some economic recovery, but there's also a lot of voices from the left who talk about the enormous deficits that were being faced. And, you know, Reich and Brinkley call it military Keynesianism. Like, okay, well, you may have stimulated the economy, but you stimulated it by building up the military. So, you know, I think those are the kinds of nuances that come through in the film that you know, maybe give viewers a better sense of what the realities are.
Yeah, and it was a large increase in military spending, wasn't it? This figure of 35% is lodged in my head. Am I right about that? It was a lot of money.
It was 35% increase, yes.
Let's go, Amy. I'm sorry, Chip. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was just going to say, we try and do a summary at the end of the show, at the end of hour one, that looks at all of the things that we've discussed from the beginning, interest rates, inflation, unemployment, increase or decrease in all of those areas. And statistically, it's kind of a mishmash. I mean, some things worked and some things didn't.
Jim in Hollandale. Hi.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
I'd kind of like to continue on in the same vein that Ray was on and highlight a couple other things that haven't been mentioned yet that I know of. Other things that Reagan did that have an enormous effect on our economy today and the conditions that exist in this country. Before Reagan went to office, I believe there were 12 laboratories that were run through Health and Human Services or one of the departments of the federal government that tested every single substance or thing that was foisted on the American people. Everything. And when Reagan was in there, he eliminated 11 of the 12. And his justification was, well, these companies are good, honest companies. When they say something's good, it's good. That was one thing he did. Another thing he did on the antitrust side of it was he removed an enormous amount of funding from the antitrust division of the Department of Justice. And he also put an element into antitrust enforcement that said you had to prove collusion before you could effectively build a case against some of these big businesses. And those things, as obviously you can see, we import all kinds of stuff from all over the world, and I use a lot of that stuff that's just junk. There's no quality control on much of any of it. And antitrust, I'm more involved in agriculture than anything else, and antitrust, we have all of the commodities that exist in agriculture in this country, from grains to beef to pork to dairy, now dairy was the last one to go down, are controlled pretty much by one or two huge transnational companies. And that wouldn't have happened had Reagan not done what he did with antitrust enforcement.
Chip.
Well, he's getting into an area that we don't focus on in the film, which is the antitrust laws. What we do, though, focus on that might appeal to him is back to the farm crisis. We get into the notion of the corporatization of the family farm, and I think part of what he's talking about would be the corporatization of all kinds of things. And so, you know, I would leave it up to the viewers and to other scholars to really talk about that. It's not something we've covered extensively in the film.
The presidency of Ronald Reagan is what we're talking about this hour. The Reagan presidency, the subject of a three-part documentary series that's being aired all over the country on PBS stations. And this hour we're talking about Reagan's presidency. We have two guests with us, well-known to you in Milwaukee particularly and Wisconsin. Chip Duncan, who's a documentary filmmaker, president of the Duncan Group, producer of this film, and Tracy Dorsey, who's also a producer of The Reagan Presidency. More phone calls momentarily. Bear with us. Lines have been busy. You'll get through eventually. 800-486-8655 is the number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, Kyle in Madison. Hi, Kyle.
Hi. Reagan was a scumbag. Period. He deregulated the medical industry. The Iran-Contra scandal, if you looked at the documents when you did your research for your movie, you would have discovered that that's what connected him to releasing the hostages late. It was totally planned by his side. And besides the hostages, go back to the savings and loan scandal. He did nothing about. He was an ineffective, illegitimate president, and we need to call him out for what he did.
Well, he was still, though, Kyle, a very influential president, and he remains an influential president in terms of philosophy. There was a great deal of opposition to him. I mean, it's interesting to me to hear a number of people who still dislike this president and dislike him so intensely so many years later. What do you think that's all about, Chip?
Well, I'm actually not surprised because I've been out speaking and doing a fair number of talks. And what's interesting, though, is the number of people who want to focus on domestic or on character. And I'd have to say if we'd had a little bit of a larger budget, we probably would have done a second hour on domestic. We only did 1 hour on domestic policy.
Yes.
So a lot of your listeners will find, you know, things that we covered that they're glad are in there. But, you know, just speaking for myself, I was very disappointed that we only have 56 minutes and 46 seconds to get across, you know, an entire 8 years of domestic policy. So there's things we didn't cover that disappointed me. I as you know, I work a lot on environmental issues, and I was, you know, chagrined that one of the cuts we had to make was an extensive part of the show on the environment, which no one's called in to talk about yet. I will say, going back to Kyle's comment about Iran-Contra, in his case, I think if he watches Hour 2 and 3, he will be very pleased with the film. And it has to do with the fact that on foreign policy related to the Middle East and Central America, we connect the dots in a way that I haven't seen in any previous film. So a lot of what is being discussed, I think you might find we're adding to a dialogue that, or continuing a dialogue that others have started. American Experience, for example, being one of them. But when it comes to foreign policy, I think we set some new ground. And on Iran-Contra, what I personally found fascinating was, having lived through the era, I knew there was a scandal going on, of course, and I was aware that we had traded arms for hostages. But, you know, you have to start digging back further and further and further back, and even ask, why were there hostages? I mean, what were the underpinnings of that? What, you know, and so the breakthroughs for me are really in Hours 2 and 3 when we discuss the Lebanese civil war, the conflict between Syria and Israel and Iran, and then eventually Iran and Iraq, and look at, okay, you know what's going on in Central America. Now you know what's going on in Lebanon and the greater Middle East. So, you know, Iran-Contra, I mean, clearly was the decisions that were made there were unconstitutional and illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's disputed in the film. It's reinforced, and yet I think viewers will find that they understand what was going on globally that led to those decisions.
And in a way that I find very interesting and was illuminating for me was how our various interview subjects then tied that to Cold War policy. So what we're seeing from this chessboard that's laid out, Central America, the Middle East, you know, the Soviet Union, et cetera, the Philippines, is how this all, in some instance, according to many of our guests, can be tied directly back to Cold War policy, not the individual regions themselves.
Mm-hmm. And two, we're getting close to the end of the show. We have tons of phone calls to get to, but to get back to a theme of this presidency, which has stayed with us, which is really crucial, I think, and it's something that presidents subsequent to Reagan have had to deal with, was his idea that government is not a solution, government is the problem. And in the last election, I think that analysts have found that most Americans believe that government is important and is not a problem. And yet, he really made a big deal of this, and even Bill Clinton had to adjust his presidency to adhere somewhat with that philosophy, didn't he, Chip?
Well, the quote that you're providing is from his first inaugural, and a lot of times people forget the first line of the quote, which is "in this present crisis." And so you have people in the film that talk about that, and Stephen Weissman being one of them, who was a New York Times journalist at the time, who said, you know, Reagan was anti-government, but he didn't govern that way. And you have people like Richard Reeves, who I think makes a really interesting analysis, which is to say, you know, much like Teddy Roosevelt went after big business, Ronald Reagan went after big government in a populist context. Now, that may have gotten him elected. I'm not sure it would get him elected today, but it may have got him. That may have been one of the reasons he was elected at the time. So, you know, the question in part is, you know, was he able to live up to that? And the answer is no. I mean, government grew significantly during Reagan's mm-hmm. period in office. And so, you know, he may have made it a campaign point. And it's almost like you look at politics today, Kathleen, you spend more time on it than anybody I know. And it's like, you look at what's going on in Iowa. You know, Jeb Bush was on the trail back in November saying there's no way Reagan could win Iowa. You know, my guess is he would just go further to the right and try and win that way. I mean, you know, he was a politician through and through. So, you know, but the question that we're trying to answer is not what did he say to get elected, but what did he do when he was elected? And look at the outcome of those policies. Some failed, some succeeded, and the question is why.
Yeah. Jerry in Milwaukee, hi.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Jerry.
Yeah, by the way, another great show. To your guests, did you cover it all? Speaking of foreign policy, the president's position on South Africa at the time, and I was very active during that time. I was curious if that was covered.
Only briefly.
Administration.
Yeah, only briefly, Jerry. And it's interesting that we have created a number of ancillary materials that are going to be available to the public. And a lot of the apartheid movement in South Africa is in the ancillary materials. But on the show itself, there's only mention of a number of conflicts that we don't cover. The Philippines is another one. I mean, Reagan obviously had a well-known relationship with Marcos, and yet we didn't have time in the constraints of our public television broadcast to get into the Philippines or Lockerbie or South Africa or Ethiopia and the famine. There's a number of things that we just didn't get into the film that we wanted to get in there.
Jerry, thanks. We have time for one more call. Skip in Milton. Hi, Skip.
Good morning. Thanks for the show and having me on. One thing that was just alluded to that I heard, but I want to make a point of it, is Reagan's choice of the Secretary of Interior, James Watt,
right,
who was put in that position, at least supposedly, to protect the environment, and who is the most anti-environmental Secretary of the Interior we ever had.
Chip, do you want to respond to that? We're running out of time.
Well, I think Skip is right in the sense that he was very disliked. I have friends in the Forest Service who said, "You've got to cover him. You've got to cover it," and just wanted to, you know, make a case for the non-James Watt position, and we weren't able to fit it into the first hour. So he was highly contentious.
Yeah. Thanks very much for your calls. So who's next on the presidential list, Chip?
Well, we're developing three more.
Oh, my goodness.
We're developing a film on Truman, a film on LBJ, and a film on Nixon that would all continue in the style of this film. So, you know, you can't really understand even Reagan without understanding Johnson. Or,
yes.
You know, so and Truman is a fascinating subject. So we're hoping that that our funders will come back and help underwrite those projects for the future.
Well, and I put in a vote, Tracy, for John Quincy Adams. No, I do. He's my new favorite guy. The guy was fascinating. Although it would be hard to do a documentary. You
Our
don't
video
have the video.
Right. Are going to be very slim there.
I know. Thank you both very much for being with us. Thanks for putting together the documentaries. They're fascinating. Thanks.
Thank
Great.
You.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Chip Duncan, filmmaker, author, photographer, president of the Duncan Group, and Tracy Dorsey. They both are producers of the Reagan Presidency, airing this month on PBS stations all over the country, three-part series. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Katie Madsen for on-air production. Be with you again Monday at 9:00.